Dear friends of Jesus Christ, I came across a cartoon, I believe in the Wall Street Journal. It pictured a family gathered around a deathbed, and one of the family members leaning in to hear what the dying person was wanting to say. And then the family asks the person, well, what did he say? And he said, I think he said, I wish I had spent more time at the office. That's a Wall Street joke. I mean, anyway, you don't think it was that funny, huh? I thought for an Easter service, you know, in the... But anyway, I just thought you'd all be, I'd have to calm you down. But I tell the joke because it's a reminder that we all need to ask ourselves at the end of the day, at the end of our lives, what is it that we hope we've accumulated? What is the nature of our treasure? What is it that we have valued, invested our time in? I mean, we are given this rare, rare opportunity to be alive. And each day we are exchanging it for what? It's easy enough in a service like this to say, okay, I am going to be making this my treasure. But as all of us know, it is so easy to grow careless, to wander and go astray. And so it is really, I mean, it's a very familiar text, but it is an important text for us to hear and to remember. When Jesus says, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moths and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal, but rather lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, because where your treasures are, that is where your heart is. Now, the question, one of the main questions this morning is to understand what exactly is the nature of these treasures about which Jesus speaks. And to get at that, I'd like to remind all of us that these few verses are of course part of the larger Sermon on the Mount. And you know, the first 18 verses of this chapter we dealt with back in January during the Epiphany season, and it deals with pious practices, almsgiving, fasting, and prayer. And then in that same section, Jesus teaches us the Lord's Prayer. We did that during Epiphany, January. Then in March, we went back to chapter 5. And we took those six samples. Do you remember the six samples that Jesus uses to illustrate how the righteousness of those who are members of the kingdom of heaven has to far exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the religious leaders? So we've just finished then, before Easter, with those sections in chapter 5. Now we're back in chapter 6. And I got to tell you, I think that there's a theme that runs through this whole chapter 6. You know, it begins with these pious practices. And what's so interesting is that when Jesus talks about fasting and praying and almsgiving, he continually warns that we not do it to be seen. So for instance, in I think it's in verse 3, he says, you know, when you're about to give a really fine gift to some poor beggar. You know, don't sound the trumpet to get praise from people. And then each time Jesus has this warning, he says, truly I tell you, I mean, if you do that, if you sound the trumpet, truly I tell you, you will receive your reward. To be noticed, being generous, is not a small matter. People admire generous people. Again, when it comes to prayer, Jesus says, don't stand on the corner of streets and pray. People will like it. Truly, I tell you, you will receive your reward. But your Father sees in secret. And then in verse 16, so this comes very close to our passage on treasures. There it's about fasting, and he says to the people who are fasting, who are showing how remorseful they are, how much they are in need of grace, he says, don't go around disfiguring your face so that everybody knows, oh, wow, he must really be a spiritual person. He says again, truly I say unto you, you will receive your reward. But your Father sees in secret. Now, in every case, what strikes me is Jesus' warning underscores that it is possible to be successful in wrong values. It is possible to be successful in wrong values. If wrong values always were downers, if wrong values always disappointed, well, they wouldn't have much of a chance. The fact of the matter is, to be seen as pious, seen as generous, they all bring their rewards. How wonderful it is to be noticed and admired and applauded. How many of us wouldn't like a nice piece that would go viral, where everybody is talking about what you wrote and thought? How insightful. Treasures. We're talking treasures here. Jesus, in this same section, still before the section on treasures, you know, gives us the Lord's Prayer. And in the prayer, I think he also says something that's important to remember when we talk about treasures. He says, the first thing that you should do when you pray to the Father in heaven is to pray that his name be hallowed. That his name, at least in your life, be given all the weight, all the gravity that God deserves. And that you pray that God's kingdom come, not your kingdom, but God's kingdom, and that his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So those are the sorts of things that Jesus is talking about. Then now we start with the treasures, and here's what follows, if you may remember this, but if you go through chapter 6, there's the discussion about the treasures. Then there's this really weird passage that we're going to try to preach about next week, which is about the single eye. And if your eye be dark, anyway, that's the next. Then the two, you can't serve two masters. You'll hate one and love the other. And then there's this very lengthy discussion on not to worry. He says the people, the Gentiles, people who don't know anything about God, they're all about what they're going to wear and how they look and what they'll eat. You who are members of the city, of the kingdom, you're of a different ilk. Seek first the kingdom. So you see where this small passage really does sort of tie in and link to what's going on in this section in the Sermon on the Mount. So Jesus says, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth. One translator has it this way. Do not take to yourselves treasure. Do not treasure to yourselves treasures of earth. when you ask yourself here, in this laying up treasures on earth, what do these treasures consist of? Most of the commentators think it has to do with money, with possession, with things. And you need to know that, of course, these things have value not in themselves so much as how they affect you. So that, for instance, this is simply a truth. Money, having money, can provide a sense of security. It makes the bumps in the road less painful. Money can give you a sense of standing. You gain stature. Money gives you power. You have access to places that a person without money has no access to. Money allows you to buy pleasures, to go places. So to make these material things your treasure, it's not a foolish thing. You can see where you might want to lay up treasures for yourselves on earth, because there's payback. Huge payback. There's a book that someone gave me. It's called Reordered Loves, Reordered Lives. And the person says that our lives get all screwed up because our loves are disordered. We love things too much, and we love some things not enough. But he begins the book by asking three questions. And they're really, I think, very insightful questions. He says, ask yourselves this now. What is it that you love? What is it that you love? Then, how do you love the things that you love? And then three, what do you expect to receive from those things that you love? These treasures. I think kind of a synonymous, something that means very much the same as treasures, is to say the things you value, the things you prize, the things you think about, the things you work hard for, the things that if you were to lose them, it would be like having them take your gods away, having them take your joy away. These are your treasures. And now Jesus says, these treasures, don't spend your life, this rare gift of being alive, don't spend it on laying up for yourself these treasures, even though, granted, there's payback. And Jesus doesn't say, don't do it because they're all bad and they're all evil. He says, don't do it. Why? Because they don't last. The shine will go off them. There are the thieves that will steal them. There is time that will wear them out. In the end, you will be disappointed. In the end, it will leave you empty. In the end, it will leave you poverty-stricken, because earthly treasures have no safe that can keep them safe. You have no vice-like grip on them. You will lose them. And so people who are realists, they write good books about necessary losses and how you how to say goodbye. Jesus says, these things, they disappoint. I have an illustration that I've used before, but it's the best that I ever came across, and so I'm going to read it to you again. And just in case some of you didn't hear it, or you've forgotten it, or you just want to be reminded of it. It's an incident. I think it's a true incident by Rodney Clapp. He's a writer. And in his book, Tortured Wonders, he tells the story of an impeccably dressed young woman who comes to church, I think it's St. Patrick's in New York, on Ash Wednesday. She goes there to receive ashes on her forehead and to hear the solemn words, "Dust you are, and to dust you will return." Now, as this young woman kneels and the priest leans forward to trace an ashen cross on her forehead, she whispers, "Father, I'm a model, and I know I only have a few years, and then I will be too old for this work. My body is aging, and I can hardly admit it to myself. I do it once a year at this service. So rub the ashes on, and rub them on hard." What the world offers in terms of treasures, in terms of finding security, standing, stature, self-respect, all that the world offers, you need to know, they fade. There's moth, there's rust, there's thieves. They will leave you forsaken and abandoned. So Jesus says, lay up for yourselves instead treasures in heaven. There neither time nor wickedness can take them from you. Neither moth nor rust consumes, and there neither thieves break in or steal. Now, what are the treasures in heaven? And of course, Jesus, again, doesn't spell it out here. But it's a really important question. What is it that we should do? Is it sort of like, you know, a sort of a spiritual layaway plan? You do some things as a kind of a down payment on your mansion in glory. Is that what we're supposed to be doing? Is it like some graduates today, to get into schools, it's not enough to have, you know, good grades, but you should also have a record where you worked in the soup kitchen and went on a medical mission trip and you did all sorts of other good things. Is that what it's meaning? Do these things, lay up these things for yourselves in heaven, and payback is big. What's the treasure? What do you think the treasure is? Just on the score, how important this question is. I was reminded of something that happened in my wife Carol's life when she was about 6 years old. Boys and girls, when my wife Carol was six, that's quite a while ago. But when she was six, they had an Easter egg hunt out in John Ball Park. And she had learned that there were prizes to be awarded, and the top prize was a bike. So Carol didn't have a bike, but she was fast, and she's determined, and so she thought she might be able to get that bike. And so she planned it this way. She made sure all the other kids came with bags. She had this large skirt, and she used that skirt as kind of a basket, so she could just, I mean, lots of room. She went flying up the hill and went looking for eggs. She had more eggs in that in her skirt, and she came up to her mom and said, "Mom, do you think I might have won the bike?" And her mom said, "Oh, honey, the bike doesn't go to the child that has the most eggs. The bike goes to the child that's found the golden egg." The golden egg. And I said to Carol, Now, you would have thought your mom would have told you that before, beforehand. And she said, well, I'm sure she did, but I was so distracted, so excited that I didn't pay any attention. And so I just assumed the more age you had, the better the chances were that you'd get the bike. So what's the golden egg? So that at the end of your life, you don't come with a whole bag of whatever that doesn't do you any good. I'm going to give you, from what Scripture teaches us, the treasure that is priceless and precious is the treasure of, this sounds so, anyway, I'm going to just say it, is having a friendship with God, being rich in God. Jesus says that at one point very plainly when he talks about the fool who has the whole world but who is poor when it comes to God. But let me give you a couple of ways in which to explore that business of friendship with God. This is a story that I read some, I don't know how many years ago, and I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember the main point, I think. There were these three angels, and God called them into his presence. And he said to the one angel, I want you, and I'm going to contemporize it, I want you to go down to earth, and I want you to protect Pope Francis. And I want to have you whisper wisdom into his ear, because he will hear many lies. Second angel, I want you to go to Washington, D.C. and protect President Obama and give him wisdom. Off he went to Washington, D.C. Next angel, I want you to go to the dump in Manila and protect this garbage collector. And he goes off. And according to the legend, all three angels are deeply and profoundly grateful for their task, because what mattered was not who it was that they were to protect, but that they were to be in service of the Lord. Now, I know you can get a little smulchy about that, but the truth of the matter is, no matter what your task, no matter how you are living your life, at what point you're living your life, what matters, what really matters, is that in the moment, you reverence God, you live your life in obedience to God. That is the treasure. That is how friendships are made. That is how a partnership exists. Friendship with God. Let me go at it in a bit of a different way. St. Augustine, in his Confessions, has this incredible piece about loving God and what it must mean for him to love God. And I remember reading it when we were in college. It was one of these, you had to read this stuff. And I don't know whether I really understood it. I'm still not quite sure I understand it, but I really like it. One of the ways that has helped me to understand it is a phrase that somebody highlighted that St. Augustine made. And the phrase was this: we have heard the facts, let us seek the mystery. We've heard the facts, let us seek the mystery. Okay, keep that in mind. Now I'm going to read to you something which is probably the best thing you'll hear today. Maybe the whole week, the whole month. Here's how it goes. Listen to this. This is St. Augustine. What do I love when I love you? Not physical beauty or the grandeur of our existence in time, or the radiance of light that pleases the eye, or the sweet melody of old familiar songs, or the fragrance of flowers and ointments and spices, or the taste of manna and honey, or the arms we like to use to clasp each other. None of these do I love when I love my God. Yet there is a kind of light and a kind of melody and a kind of fragrance and a kind of food and a kind of embracing when I love my God. They are the kind of light and sound and odor and food and love that affect the senses of the inner man. There is another dimension of life in which my soul reflects a light that space itself cannot contain. It hears melodies that never fade with time. It inhales lovely scents that are not blown away by the wind. It eats without diminishing or consuming the supply. It never gets separated from the embrace of God and never gets tired of it. That is what I love when I love my God. St. Augustine, he goes out into the creation, right? And he asks the birds and the water and the sun and he asks everything, are you God? And they say, no, we are not God. We have been made by God. And then Augustine says, I questioned them by fixing my attention on them, and their beauty was their answer. Now, what I understand in all of this is that for St. Augustine, to love God meant not to put the world to the side as somehow secondary and of no great importance. It was rather to take all the beauty, all the fragrance, all the loveliness, and to penetrate to the very heart of those things and to see both the maker and the beauty of the one who made these things. So that everything became for him a sign and a seal of God's care, that everything became a way of communion with God. And I tell you, if you and I could dedicate ourselves to live lives where the most ordinary of things, a piece of bread, a little bit of wine, a good meal at home, a loving embrace from a friend, if all of that could become for us signs and seals of God's love for us, and we would treat everything accordingly, we would become rich. Now, I'm going to finish with another story. And this one, again, to the boys and girls, because I'm not sure St. Augustine, well, it's pretty hard to understand. So let me tell you a story, and I'm going to finish with it. It's a story that I heard, and I'm using it for my purpose, but I first heard it from Reverend Boomsma. He was my minister when I was in college, and I liked him a lot, and he told children's stories. And boys and girls, he told one about a box. He said in his church was a lawyer, big shot lawyer, really, and he had this client who had been very wealthy, and he had written a will for her, and she died. And so he takes out the will, and he of course knew that the woman, this very wealthy woman, had adopted a son when he was just a very tiny boy, who was now a grown man living in California. Well, he also reads that she has this box, and that she has deposited the box in a bank, in a vault in Chicago. So he decides that before he has the young man from California come to Grand Rapids to hear the will, he'll bring the box in. So he takes the plane ride to Chicago, goes to the bank. They give him the box. Of course, the bank has no idea what's in the box. But because he was a very wealthy lady, they figured not to be careless with this. And so they send the man with the box back to O'Hare, or wherever they were flying off from there, with two escorts to make sure that nothing happened to the box. He's on the plane. He doesn't want to check it in. He puts it on his lap. He comes into Grand Rapids, and he's too late to bring it to the bank, and so he puts it under his bed. And he doesn't sleep well. He gets up early in the morning, goes to the bank, checks it into a bank, then writes this young man to come in to hear the will. So he comes in. And of course, everybody is curious as to what is in the box. And this really times it. Boonstra then says, and all the girls in the office also came in. Everybody comes in, right? Everybody comes in. And he opens the box. And what do you think was in the box? A Rector set and a fire red fire engine and a whole bunch of these little toys. And everybody just howls and thinks, this is the strangest old woman possible. But the boy understood immediately. These were the gifts that he had given when he came into her house, and they had become the means through which he had become joined to his new mother. That little fire truck was a sign and a seal of their love for each other. Nothing is just ordinary, you see. For believers, everything becomes a sign and a seal of God's care for us, of God's presence among us. And so for you and me to live our lives fruitfully, successfully, we're not to lay up treasures for ourselves on earth, earthly treasures, and use them to bolster our ego, to provide for us a sense of security. No, we are to seek the treasure that is invulnerable, that cannot be taken from us. The treasure of being rich in God, of being a worker with God in his kingdom, of being a friend of God. That's the treasure. That's what we should cultivate in everyday life and in worship. Always that treasure, so that at the end of our lives, we will be rich in God. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.